I will open the Joint Committee on Legislative Audits for March 21st, 2017. We have three items on the agenda. The first item on the agenda is an informational hearing on Office of Secretary of State's Audits Division update on completed audits and audit activity. And my understanding is this is going to be on the ODOT-related audit and the municipal audits. Please come forward. Ann, did you want anything?
No.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Devlin and McLean, and members of the committee. For the record, Mary Winger. I'm the interim director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. I'm going to provide you a very brief update of audits we've issued since our last update to you on February 21st, and then we're going to share the results of two recently issued audit reports. So since that last meeting, we've issued three reports. We've issued the summary report on municipal reports that were filed for the fiscal year ended 2015. And Amy Dale, our municipal audit manager, is going to provide you an update on that report. We've also issued a performance audit report of ODOT. The purpose of that report was to determine if ODOT is effectively monitoring project changes to prevent unwarranted costs. We found that ODOT should better scrutinize construction costs and project changes by tracking line item bids and abnormally higher or lower prices. We will present Andrew Love, who is our audit manager for performance. He will present that one to you as well today. And then we've also released a financial statement audit of the Columbia Gorge Commission. This is a very small financial audit. We have an interstate cooperative agreement with Washington State auditors. They are the principal auditor on that report, but we audit the financial transactions of the commissioners that interact in Oregon, and then we provide them the results of our audit. And they compile a report, and then both state audit offices post the results of that audit to our websites. So I'm happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'm going to turn it over to Amy for the municipal audit summary report.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you go back? You said you did another audit on ODOT, or the one we're going to go through?
The one we're going to go
through. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Devlin and McLean and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Dale. I'm a CPA and the Municipal Audit Manager at the Audits Division of the Secretary of State. I'm here to discuss the Municipal Summary Report the division issued on March 1. This report summarizes the financial reporting of Oregon Municipal Corporations and their compliance with municipal audit law for fiscal year 2015. Municipal audit law requires all Oregon municipal corporations to submit an annual financial report to the Secretary of State. The 2015 Legislative Assembly amended municipal audit law to require the Secretary to annually prepare a summary report providing information about municipal corporations' compliance with municipal audit law. Oregon has about 1,800 municipal corporations, including counties, cities, school districts, and special districts. Of those, 1,144 filed audit reports for fiscal year 2015. The remaining local governments incurred less than $500,000 in expenditures, so they weren't required to have an audit. Instead, they either filed a review report or self-prepared cash basis financial statements with the Audits Division. The information included in the summary report is prescribed in statute and relates only to those 1,144 audits filed for the division for fiscal year 2015. The annual summary report includes information about the timely filing of reports, delinquent reports, deficiencies noted in the audits, and municipal corporations' plans to address those deficiencies. Audits of local governments are performed by municipal auditors licensed by the Oregon Board of Accountancy. Most local governments have a June 30 fiscal year end, with audits due by December 31st, about 6 months later. Local governments may request an extension of time to file their audits, and if the extension is approved, the audit report is considered timely if it's filed within that approved extended deadline. Based on our review of the audits filed for fiscal year 2015, we noted that 70% were filed timely. 70% of those had clean audit reports with no substantial deficiencies reported. 30% reported one or more substantial findings or noncompliance. The majority of those findings were internal control deficiencies, which I'll talk about in a minute. 24 municipal corporations at the time we issued our report had not filed their 2015 fiscal year-end audit report. And I checked yesterday, and 10 of those had submitted their reports. So currently there's 14 local governments that are delinquent for that 2015 filing. And it includes two cities, one charter school, three fire districts, and eight special districts. Most local governments receive a clean audit report each year without any qualifications or deficiencies. Deficiencies may be reported for weaknesses in internal control, accounting errors and misstatements, or noncompliance with rules, regulations, or grant requirements. Professional standards require an auditor to communicate material weaknesses and significant deficiencies in writing to the municipal corporation's governing body, and a file of that communication is to be filed with the secretary. Such weaknesses and deficiencies are those that are severe enough that it's reasonably possible a material misstatement could occur and not be prevented or detected and corrected on a timely basis, or they're important enough to merit the attention of the governing body. Most local governments in Oregon are relatively small and operate with a limited number of staff and resources. Of the deficiencies reported in 2015, 79% were related to internal controls. A common internal control weakness reported is a lack of segregation of duties. Frequently, there may be only one or two individuals performing all the administrative and accounting functions, with no real way to adequately segregate the functions of authorization, record keeping, and custody of assets. When this deficiency exists, the auditor will often recommend the municipality initiate independent reviews and closer monitoring by management and elected officials. Another common internal control weakness occurs when municipal staff are unable to prepare financial statements in accordance with professional standards, which requires a high level of skill and training. Smaller governments often cannot afford to hire qualified staff to prepare the financial statements due to the limited resources they have, so they contract with the independent auditor to prepare the statements for them. The remaining reported deficiencies generally fall under noncompliance, such as with local budget law or Oregon's public contracting law, or their accounting errors or misstatements. Municipal audit law stipulates that the governing body of the municipal corporation is required to determine the corrective measures necessary to address any of the deficiencies reported. A plan of action identifying the corrective measures and an estimate of time it will take to implement those corrections is to be filed with the secretary. Only about 30% of the required auditor communications and plans of action were filed for 2015. This low statistic is likely due to the changes in the law. We have communicated the changes several times to municipalities and auditors and have seen improvement. We expect compliance to continue to increase as the municipalities gain a better understanding of the new legislation. Since the amendments to the law, we've already seen a decline in the number of delinquent filers and in the average amount of time it takes municipalities to file their reports with the audits division. I hope you found the report and this testimony useful, and I welcome your feedback as it will help improve future reporting. So thank you for the opportunity to present, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions from the committee?
I guess I have one.
Yeah.
You indicated that most of the infractions were either contracting law or budget law, and so that is this something that you find to be on all reports, that those are two very high level areas of concerns? And or I want to know if you're finding any trends in a particular type of contracting law or a particular type of budget law that maybe there needs to be some improvement or review.
So co-chairs and members of the committee, that's an excellent question. And non-compliance findings are one of the smaller findings that we do have, but within that type of finding, the most common are in local budget law and contracting. Municipal audit law requires auditors specifically to look at these compliance requirements along with a host of others. Mm-hmm. And usually the infractions have to do with, for local budget law, it's in the preparation or adoption or execution of their budget. By far, the most common is overexpended appropriations. And that could be $1. Mm-hmm. It could be thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And it's the auditor's judgment that's performing that engagement on how significant that is. So it could be just a frequent occurrence, or it could be a large dollar amount that makes that significant enough that they need to comment on that. For the contracting, A lot of the smaller governments may forget, or they don't have the ability to go out and get multiple bids when they're purchasing capital assets or things over $10,000. So that's usually common. I wouldn't say that it's pervasive across all the municipalities, but for that type of finding, those tend to be the most common reasons.
Okay. Thank you.
I do have a couple of questions in terms of, I saw the listing in terms of, well, when you find issues within audits, how you categorize them in terms of internal control, accounting errors, and basic compliance. How often do you find things that are a little bit more than just they don't have competent staff? I mean, I'm not talking perhaps at a true level of sort of malfeasance, but I mean, truthfully, just, well, kind of analogous to somebody not being able to keep a checkbook.
Right.
In the old days when people kept checkbooks, so I'll date myself.
Hey, I still have a checkbook. Co-Chair Devlin, McLean, members of the committee. That's also a really good question. I think it's less common than we might think. Typically, the scenario is we have a lot of very small special districts, and they may have one staff and maybe some volunteers if they're lucky. And the knowledge it takes to prepare the financial statements might exceed their ability. Their bookkeeper, accounting and reporting standards can be complex, and they're ever-changing and difficult to keep up with. But the type of malfeasance where somebody's actually doing wrong, or there's just gross negligence in keeping those records, I think that's probably pretty uncommon. I think most people really do try to do a good job with the resources that they have. It's just a big task.
Well, we know the true occurrence of malfeasance is actually probably pretty rare. I happen to have a circumstance in my district. It's been quite a while, but the former finance director of the city of West Lynn was released from prison in 2012 for embezzling about $1.4 million. So it does occasionally happen.
Yeah. Generally, when that happens, too, co-chairs and members of the committee, if the auditor does find an indication of wrongdoing, there are professional standards they have to follow for reporting that, and they may need to increase audit procedures. Potentially, they could still opine on the financial statements if they're able to substantiate that they are accurate, but they might have other disclosure requirements or reporting that they have to do around that we would see.
Okay. By the way, members of the committee, I did look through the list of, and I didn't go down to my smallest water district, but I went through all my cities, all my counties, all my school districts, and none of them have any compliance there issues.
Great. You live in a good area.
I guess I didn't get a chance to review all mine. When I first came in the building, we had the county sheriff, remember, embezzled money from the Camp Sherman Fire District and pleaded guilty to a felony for 5 years in prison and a $500,000 fine, which he paid with cash, which was suspicious. But my comment is, I get concerned about some ability of small districts, to contract out for this or how they get it done. I have a bill that I hope will stay alive for a while, that school districts have been doing this with their pension obligation bonds. They go out and borrow money to pay their PERS obligation without any citizen review. It doesn't require a vote of the people, and they go out and borrow money to pay their PERS obligation, which is borrowing money to pay your debt. I'm concerned about that. So I think I'd agree with the chair that I worry about some of the small school districts and some of the my background is military, and we have an agency developed to do financial management and contracting, and we're going to get into the ODOT, and it applies really there in that. I don't know if when I first came in, the legislative council was contracting out the printing of our laws. Oh, Therese was on. But they were in charge of the contract. And they were just renewing the contract every year instead of rebidding it, because the guy was only going up 10%. And this was a company, our laws were being printed by a printing company in Kentucky or Missouri, and it wasn't being rebid. So, and they were doing it out of convenience, let's face it. They didn't want to be bothered with it. That's not their expertise. So we did pass a law saying you have to compete bids at least every 2 years, because the Oregon companies that could not qualify to get the original contract but had not been allowed to compete in the future because the guy kept extending the contract, so he didn't have to go through that. So I do worry about agencies and that don't have the expertise to contract or to do financial audits. So I wish we could find a solution, but I don't know what it is. I haven't found it. Thank you for your report.
Thank you.
Oh, go ahead. Anything additional?
No.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Not a single one had a trouble, Senator.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair, Senator Devlin, and Representative McLean, and committee members. For the record, my name is Andrew Love, and I am the audit manager with the Oregon Audits Division, specifically with the Performance Audit Section. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an overview of our 2017 audit of Oregon Department of Transportation titled ODOT Should Better Scrutinize Construction Costs and Project Changes by Tracking Line Item Bids with Abnormally High or Low Prices. The Oregon Department of Transportation manages roughly 8,000 miles of state highway, roads, and bridges, approximately $2 billion of ODOT's total $3.6 billion budget for the 2015-17 biennium was allocated to its highway division, which designs, builds, and maintains Oregon's highway system. The agency spends roughly $400 million a year, constructing highway, bridge, and other infrastructure projects. Our audit objective was to determine whether ODOT is effectively monitoring construction project changes to prevent unwarranted costs. We focused on the agency's effort to monitor project changes related to unbalanced bid items. We found that ODOT has processes in place to manage changes to its construction projects, but the agency does not track unbalanced bid items, which can lead to increased costs. Part of our work, we obtained ODOT data on 651 construction projects completed over a five-year period from 2011 and 2015. Concentrating our work on the 413 projects managed solely by ODOT. We conducted a detailed review of records for 11 of these 413 projects to determine whether project changes appeared to be adequately documented and reasonable. In general, we found that the contract change orders, overruns, and increases contained the required approvals, had adequate supporting documentation, and included reasonable explanation for why the changes were needed. We noted that changes paid for by federal stimulus funds, however, did not always include complete explanations, but were approved by the Federal Highway Administration, which provided the funding. ODOT has established processes for managing construction project changes. It requires all contract change orders to be reviewed by an area manager or regional manager, as well as the contract administration engineer. Significant contract changes, such as those that alter the scope of the project or certain material specifications, also require the approval of a licensed engineer or other licensed professional. More costly construction project changes require additional approvals. Project overruns, which range up to $500,000, must be reviewed by at least a regional manager and the ODOT construction section. Project increases valued at $500,000 or more must be approved by the Highway Division Administrator or the Oregon Transportation Commission. However, when we analyzed data from the 413 ODOT construction projects, we found that more than two-thirds exceeded their bid amounts. While the combined cost of those projects came to $1.8 billion, slightly below the total estimated cost of $1.9 billion, they exceeded their bid amounts by about 6.6%. These figures suggest to us that ODOT has some room to improve in its management of some project costs. State and federal laws generally require ODOT to award construction contracts to the lowest bidder. As a result, contractors sometimes submit abnormally low or high prices on certain line items in a contract or bid items, causing their entire bid to be considered unbalanced. This is known as unbalanced bidding. The contractor's overall goal in submitting an unbalanced bid is to maximize profit while still keeping the overall bid low. When using unbalanced bids, contractors may bid high prices on line items for which they think ODOT might have underestimated the quantity that they will be needed. An unbalanced bid can have underestimated quantities that will be needed. An unbalanced bid can also come about because a contractor believes they have better methods for addressing an element of construction projects that could reduce construction costs. However, unbalanced bids can increase costs if construction projects are later changed, such as through a contract change order, overrun, or increase. ODOT considers any bid item at least 20% and $25,000 above or below the estimated cost to be unbalanced. Analyzing the data for the 413 ODOT projects, we found that over 90% of projects contained at least one unbalanced bid item, and 61% had one or more bid items that were at least double their estimated costs. Additionally, 4 of the 11 projects we reviewed in detail had at least one change order, overrun, or increase that was related to a significantly unbalanced bid item that resulted in high project costs. Total costs associated with these unbalanced bid items equaled roughly $2.8 million, and these projects ended up exceeding their overall bids by anywhere from $268,000 to $1.4 million. However, this does not automatically indicate that changes were problematic or avoidable, or that cost increases were necessarily questionable. ODOT has systems to track bid items and contract project changes, but these systems do not track which bid items are unbalanced or which project changes are related to unbalanced bid items. Furthermore, these systems are not linked together, so ODOT is unable to look across all projects for patterns of unbalanced bid items related to project changes. The only way to compare project changes to unbalanced bid items across all projects is through a manual review of each project's documentation, which is time-consuming and not practical on a system-wide level. Without tracking data on unbalanced bids, ODOT does not have a clear idea how many unbalanced bid items are tied to construction project changes. If ODOT tracked these costs, it could determine whether project changes related to unbalanced bids are directly leading to increased costs and could begin evaluating the factors that contribute to those project changes. The agency could also analyze whether cost or quantity estimates for certain unbalanced bid items may need to be modified for future projects. To evaluate whether unbalanced bidding is negatively affecting project costs or bid competition, we recommended that ODOT track unbalanced bid items either within existing systems or separately, include related bid item numbers in contract change orders, overrun increases, and track them. Conduct regular analysis of change orders, overruns, and increases related to unbalanced bid items and evaluate whether unbalanced bidding is negatively affecting project cost or bid competition. Provide project managers with more guidance on how to manage unbalanced bid items. The agency generally agreed with our recommendations, though they disagree with some of the analysis we present in the audit report. Thank you for your time. I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions from the committee? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Love, thank you for going through that.
Thank you.
As a layman, let me understand what you've said. And I think it was in the article, it was in Oregon Live, ODOT loses money on contractors gaming the system. So what you're saying, your audit discovered that contractors are underbidding to get the low bid on, and certain items they look at, they know that there'll be a change order. They're estimating a change order will bring enough new demand that will offset what their low bid was. Is that summarizing it? Am I on the right track? Or
co-chairs and committee members, that is one reason for why they could be submitting unbalanced bids. There's several other reasons that could be included. One could be they could specialize in a particular area. So a pavement or asphalt group who has done roads in that area knows the costs a little bit better than others and can compete better in those areas. And some other reasons is that they may they lower a bid for a particular item for another bid where they think they'll have to spend more money on. So they'll be able to eat the cost on one end, knowing that they're trying to get to the lowest overall bid items. But there are instances where, and that is a risk, where people are lowering their costs or raising, adjusting their prices with the idea of whether that they could change the contract later on.
I have two little short. So, okay.
Yes.
Co-chair, thank you.
Yeah.
So what's Secretary of State's audit division? How do we stop this? Or what did you have, you know, are we just saying ODOT do a better job? Is that, because that's what I'm seeing, that there's not any policy that we can do or give to ODOT that will clarify this.
Mm-hmm.
And second, if you could talk about, did your audit look into the quality checks of pavement thickness and wear? I had an experience in my career that we had a whistleblower that was saying that they were not getting good quality examination of the thickness of the asphalt. It was going down, and that's why in Central Oregon we have all those ruts in the in the roads.
Well, co-chairs, committee members, let me answer your second question first. We did not look into a specific contract changes. Fortunately, our office is not made up of engineers, and see ourselves as experts in controls. So we looked at whether the agency had the right controls in place to ensure that all projects get the appropriate level of scrutiny. We didn't look at individual contract changes with an expert's eye in terms of whether the asphalt's met up to code. To go back to your first question, which I almost forgot, could you repeat your first question? I'm sorry.
Well, did you come up with, you know, you're saying, what you're saying is you do have the expertise, you know, you found these things, but what's the chain, you know, what's the recommendation, specific recommendation to save the taxpayers money in the future that we're not, you know, we're eliminating this underbidding on the parts?
Well, our recommendation is that the agency start looking at these unbalanced bid items and tracking the project changes. So the practices of unbalanced bidding comes about because we have a process where it's the lowest bidder wins, based on some other factors as well. But generally, the lowest bidder is the winner of the contract. And then the practice of unbalanced bids has been upheld in courts to some degree. The practice of a fully unbalanced bid where the state can expect to lose money on that contract, they could take legal action and not take that bid, but that's pretty hard to prove, especially when you're looking at some of the bids being close to each other. So we're asking that the agency, they already identify the items that are unbalanced bids, especially the ones that are particularly high and somewhat risky. What they're not doing is tracking contract changes in the back end to make sure they don't tie back to those unbalanced bid items. Another piece of tracking unbalanced bids where they could have an advantage is they could look at projects over time to see where is there particular items that we put out there are contractors consistently underbidding or overbidding and expecting project changes down the line. So they could modify their estimating process to make those changes so that that doesn't occur in the future.
Thank you very much for that clarification.
I
yes, Representative McClain.
Go ahead.
Okay. I think it's on, I was trying to look for a page number. I think it's page 5. You were talking about, you know, what is the procedure if there has been an unbalanced bid or something and there's going to be some type of a contract change order that's actually going to be needed because now something is costing more or more than the line item was supposed to cost. They have to go through a contract change order, a CCO. And it looks here like there is a process in place for that and also large overruns, which indicate that they have to indicate right there what the overrun was or what the cost is, why that cost is there. And it sounds like the list coincides with some of your suggestions, which is, you know, basically this is the reason, this is the criteria, this is why we, you know, are going forward with a CCO or with an overrun. And so I wanted you to kind of connect your analysis, because that seemed disconnected in the report to me. Because the process that they have to do or use to even be able to pay for it really takes into consideration some of the things that you were asking them to track.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to understand that.
One of the benefits that I mentioned before, excuse me, co-chairs, committee members, one of the benefits they talk about is tracking these things over time. I guess within a particular instance, it may seem reasonable, partly because their estimates in the beginning could have been off. So they see a new price and they're like, okay, this still makes sense. But if they're starting to look back and say, hey, our estimates are always off, mm-hmm. They may, for that particular instance, think it's okay. But if they look at them over time, they may find some areas where they can improve their estimates. And then part of what we're asking, and what they already ask their staff to do, is they flag these unbalanced bid items, but they're not telling them what they should do with them. So unless they know particularly whether, like, what a flag means in terms of should I be paying more attention to this item? Is this an item for which we should reject unless they show extreme circumstances for why they need to increase these things? A lot of times, as we review things, particularly based on probably the amounts, there's a level of scrutiny that goes along with these things. And some of these items that we talk about here are big, big items, and these unbalanced bids can be in items that seem small but add up over the life of the contract, like flaggers or things like the measurement of the asphalts, for which they may not notice in a contract change. But when you look back at a project, they could see that these are things that they should be monitoring in the future.
I guess the only follow-up is that on page 6, you made a statement that said that ODOT has a defined review process for the project changes, and construction projects were reviewed generally and had appropriate approvals and explanations.
Mm-hmm.
And however, about a quarter of the projects still end up costing more than ODOT estimates. So again, you know, it sounds to me like they were doing what you were asking them to do, or had processes in place to be able to do it. And so I'm assuming that your answer is the same on this, and that is that you still believe that they need to somehow take that quarter down if those processes are standing up to what you consider to be the standard they need to stand up to. Is that kind of what you're saying, or
a little bit? I do want to clarify, when we were talking about that, they have process in place, and then the 11 contracts that we reviewed, 11 out of the 413 had the appropriate approvals, except for some of those that were federally funded, where some of the explanations weren't there. What we didn't look at to see if those explanations from an engineer's eye were appropriate. And so what could happen is someone may not be paying close attention to the details for smaller pieces or smaller items, and not knowing that this item was flagged, that we should pay a particular close attention to that particular item and be aware of any kind of contract changes. They may miss something in there. And so we're asking them to both look at them, flag them, and then do analysis after the fact, not just during the process, to see, like I said, if a particular item is always being underbid or overbid, and that they can change their process in the estimate part so that that doesn't occur in the future.
Okay, thanks.
Yes.
So, a couple of things. When you're talking about unbalanced items and tracking it over time, does that include that kind of line item? No matter who, whether contractor or tracking it by contractor.
So they have, committee chairs, members of the committee, they have a process for identifying which items within a contract is unbalanced bid, and they do identify those. We're asking them, okay, so now look at your contract changes and tie them back to those items, and to make sure to see if there's some kind of relationship between those. And so that you may actually, when you look at that in an aggregate, you may see some of that where a particular construction company does this, or a particular, you may find that in a certain area that they're always finding these unbalanced bids. But we are looking at it at the bid item level.
But your basic answer is both.
Yes.
Okay.
We're saying track it now, track it at that line item, but you may see things when you're analyzing it in the aggregate.
Okay. And an unbalance can be either overbid or underbid, mm-hmm. and then but to be flagged, then there needs to be changes. Is that correct? So if it's overbid or underbid, that's not what causes the problem. It's the changes later.
Committee chairs, members of the committee, you are correct. I think unbalanced bidding in itself is not problematic in terms of unless there is some issue with fair competition where they're unbalanced, they're so far underneath that they're affecting competition. The problem is when the project changes occur. So someone can elect to eat the cost for a particular item. And I don't know if the state should be in the position to tell people what they should be offering in terms of the construction piece. But the problem is if they're lowering the price with the intent of raising it with a contract change and hiding it in some other way, that's where it becomes a challenge. And how we identify with this when we were looking at bid amounts, we're seeing almost 90% of these projects have these unbalanced bids, and it looks like the bid amounts is not – we're paying more in the end than what we pay in the bid amount, and even more than what we estimated. And so there's a lot of different other factors that could play into that, and the agency did note that in their response. But this is one factor that nationally is an issue, and the federal government has some guidance and asks that states be tracking this information.
Finally, so you talked about the fact that this occurs because we do lowest bid contracting. Would you recommend that we do value bidding contracting? Or
our audit didn't look into what's the best, co-chairs, members of the committee. Our focus was not on what's the best bidding practice, and I would suggest that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater to make this small correction. I think that there's additional work that could be had in terms of looking at whether what's the best contracting practice for the state for the highway. I do know that is the prevailing practice in state highway is the lowest bid.
Thank you.
Additional? Yeah. I just had a question that is more of a basic question. Mm-hmm. In this particular process, the underlying implication, and I'm just trying to verify if that implication is true, is that in project estimates, they can break things down into distinct enough elements and have in place distinct, literally, costs for each one of those elements that they can compare these. Mm-hmm. How broadly is that true in the sense of, I obviously know that some of the people that some of us visit on occasion, like auto body shops and people that replace roofs and, they have pretty good tools right now to estimate exactly what it would take to do every job. They might have a different price for each item, but they have pretty good ideas of what the labor hours would be, et cetera, et cetera. How clear is that, like, in the bidding process on transportation projects?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, they submit with their entire bid all the line items, and they can be up to 1,000 different line items for a particular project, depending on what size and what the type of project it is. It's pretty detailed work.
But are there national standards? Are there uniform standards for those?
ODOT has some uniform standards for the particular items, but it doesn't account for the what's occurring on the ground, and so that's where the estimates come in. So asphalt generally could be, and these are just off the top of my head estimates and not real numbers, it could be 3 inches for asphalt, but in a particular area based on the weather, based on the conditions on the ground, that it would need additional. And so that's where they do more estimates at the agency level, and then the construction on the other end, the project contractors are doing their own work looking at what pieces can they put together to create the lowest bidding project that's also profitable for the contractor.
Okay. Any additional questions?
I think this really clarified. I read the report and I heard the report, but I think hearing the testimony helped clarify what they found for me.
Okay. Thank you very much. And now we'll go on to the next final item on the agenda, the Oregon Business Development Department response to the Secretary of State. So if those parties would come forward, and Ms. McHugh, do we have anything in advance we want to say? Or?
No, if you recall, we heard about this audit from the Secretary of State, I believe, at our last meeting, or the meeting before, actually. It was at our first meeting. And part of our process is going to be to have agencies have a chance to come and talk about the audit from their perspective as well. And so we've asked them to be here today.
Anything on the list about it?
Yes.
The audit is on is attached to today's today's committee meeting materials.
Thank you.
Please begin.
Co-Chair McLean, Co-Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Harder, Director of the Oregon Business Development Department. Thank you for the opportunity to provide our remarks on the Secretary of State audit for economic development incentives and loans. Business Oregon invests in Oregon communities, businesses, and people to promote a globally competitive, diverse, and inclusive economy. How we approach this work is both broad and deep. It includes rural community development and infrastructure financing, business retention, expansion, and recruitment, export promotion, investments in industry innovation, and technical assistance to small businesses. Financial assistance to companies is one tool we use to support business growth. Our agency's incentives and loans are important to ensure economic prosperity in rural and urban areas. They have contributed to a competitive Oregon economy. The audit report confirmed that our incentives and loans have a positive impact in the form of job creation and income tax payments to the state. The audit report also confirms the importance of the strategic planning process we proactively launched in September, which will inform the use of our incentives and loans. Our strategic planning process has identified investment priorities related to rural prosperity, economic opportunity for underserved populations, small business growth and innovation, and quality job creation. It will also include updating agency-level success metrics and program-level targets and goals, which were referenced in the audit. Business Oregon generally agrees with the audit recommendations. As such, we welcome the Secretary of State's assessments as a means to help us improve the use and effectiveness of our programs and services. Some of the findings in the report were self-identified during our own internal audit in 2015. Implementation had been initiated prior to this report. Other findings are beyond the scope of the agency and will require a partnership with local government and/or the legislature. With me today is Ramona Rademacher, Assistant Director for Operations and Finance, who served as our agency's point person during the audit. And I would now like to turn it over to Ramona to summarize our management response.
Co-Chairs Devlin and McLean, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ramona Rademacher. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations and Finance for Business Oregon. To begin, I want to highlight four of the overarching findings taken directly from the Secretary of State's audit report of Business Oregon. Number one, Business Oregon programs helped add new jobs, and workers filling these jobs generated positive returns to the state through income tax payments. Number two, Oregon has recently made a number of improvements in reporting awards to individual businesses, putting it near the top in state rankings and improving public accountability. Number three, Business Oregon has developed new, more thorough processes for making strategic reserve fund awards. And finally, number four, Business Oregon is in compliance with all current laws and regulations. While we appreciate the report's recognition of the work we've done thus far, we remain committed to continuous improvement and will work to continue to refine our processes and build on these successes in the future. To summarize our management response to the audit, I want to note three areas in which we have already taken significant steps to address the Secretary of State's recommendations, and I also need to note a few areas where we do not believe the Secretary of State auditor's recommendations are actionable because they conflict with a number of state and federal disclosure laws, or they would necessitate significant changes to multiple agency reporting structures and responsibilities, which are also defined in law. So far, what we've done, to begin with, what we've done so far, even though the audit was just released in December, we have already taken a number of steps in in addition to the strategic planning process activities that Director Harder referenced, to make additional improvements to our processes. They include, one, as part of Business Oregon's efforts to use thorough underwriting processes to ensure that we make good defensible loans and incentive awards, we've already begun taking a close look at our strategic reserve award workflow processes. The changes that we've made so far incorporate the work that was done by both our internal audit in 2015 as well as the more recent Secretary of State's audit. To date, we have strengthened the SRF Strategic Reserve Fund decision-making, contracting, and monitoring processes to include steps such as for each award, we conduct a thorough review of each company's financial records to assess the pros and cons of making the award. We have begun holding monthly meetings in which we bring together a multidisciplinary team to review the application and financials for each company. We discuss and address any concerns about the award by modifying loan terms and conditions and informing our negotiations with those companies. And then finally, we share these deliberations with the governor and her staff before requesting signature on the Strategic Reserve Fund memo. These improvements were completed in January of 2017, which was 1 month after the Secretary of State audit was issued. I have flowcharts that describe each of these processes. If you have any interest in seeing those, I'd be happy to share those. Number two, while to our knowledge we've always been in compliance with all statutory reporting and transparency statutes and guidelines, in October of 2016, we took the initiative to work with the DAS Office of Transparency to put to create a web link on their website so anyone going onto their website could access our program outcome, our agency specific outcome measures by going directly from the transparency site to our site. We also placed a reciprocal link on our website directing any of our customers to the Office of Transparency. In that way, we were able to not only provide access to the reports that are provided by the Office of Transparency, but also some of the additional analysis that we perform in our office. We see this as a first step in managing our own data sets, uploading real-time data, and ultimately providing the kind of program-specific outcome information that will most benefit our customers. Unfortunately, we do need to take issue with some of the recommendations that established the job creation targets and outcomes for 15 separate programs that were listed in the Secretary of State audit report. As their own chart notes, only 9 of the programs that were listed on the chart belong to Business Oregon. And then of those 9, only 4 of those programs that were listed actually have job creation as a goal for the program. So 40% of the programs are located in other departments, and then the rest are traditional loan programs that are used for things like working capital, bridge loans, equipment purchases, and other business type investments. And so retroactively applying a standard of job creation to programs that weren't intended for that purpose, that creates a problem for us on an outcome measure basis. Third, both our internal audit and the Secretary of State audit reports recommended that we formalize our policies and procedures for changing loan terms. We've begun to examine these processes as we upgraded our contracting and project monitoring workflows. It's our plan to further define those conditions under which we offer contract amendments and outline a menu of contracting options and terms to use. We're going to use that newly formed multidisciplinary team to vet those contract modifications. We also have already begun tracking these modifications in our customer relations management database for our business finance programs. That takes us to the areas where we believe that may not currently be actionable without some law changes. The audit recommends that Business Oregon require a sunset review of all tax expenditures and ensure enterprise zone reports are complete and accurate, including gathering job and wage data for long-term rural enterprise zones. While we have a long history of voluntarily contributing to these efforts and are happy to participate in any future evaluation of various tax abatement programs, other agencies possess the statutory authority to direct and compel these activities. We do not. Local boards of county commissioners propose and approve the zones. Our role is to make an administrative determination about whether they meet the statutory guidelines. It's essentially a check-the-box kind of activity. At that point, tax assessors manage and report on the various enterprise zones, and the Department of Revenue collects and evaluates the tax data. The Legislative Revenue Office conducts sunset reviews. And so as you can see from my description, in Oregon anyway, we have a very decentralized process of managing this. In short, our role is limited to a brief administrative function, and other agencies have greater access to data and are better staffed to assess and report on these programs. And in fact, they have the responsibility in statute at times. These programs that we're talking about actually make up $535 million or 79% of the $680 million in programs that the report mentions. Number two, areas where we think aren't actionable at this time, the audit further recommends that we work with other agencies and that the legislature to address current disclosure limitations due to confidentiality rules and laws. This would require at least three state and at least one federal law change at this time. Plus, it would require us as a state agency to advocate for policy changes, which is not our understanding of Business Oregon's role as a state agency. We're more in the implementation role at this point. We're happy to advise, but advocating it seems difficult for us. Our job creation numbers, unlike metrics used in many other states, use actual employment and Department of Revenue data to determine whether businesses have created the number of full-time jobs that they've promised and the amount of tax revenue these jobs generate. Section 303 of the Social Security Act, as well as Oregon Revised Statute 657 and 118, specifically protects this information from disclosure. In addition, ORS 192 exempts applicants' financial statements, tax information, production, sales, cost data, and other information that could reveal a company's financial status or competitive strategies. In short, the current law prohibits us from disclosing the recipient-level data about financial information that the report asks us to disclose. And the interagency agreement we have entered into with the Oregon Employment Department limits our ability to disclose job and wage data that's specific to companies. If we violate the terms of this agreement, we lose access to verifiable job data and income data that we use to track our key performance measures and to evaluate our programs. What this means, maybe one of the easiest way to describe it is to compare it to another state that the report mentions and just talk to you a little bit about how our data is different from their data. The report basically touts Wisconsin as having a really good system for reporting data. Well, that's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison. Wisconsin, first of all, is not a state agency. It's a public-private partnership. They only have, in terms of a loan portfolio, about 5% of the loans that Business Oregon carries on its books, and they have about 2.5 times the staff who do reporting. When they disclose their data, what they do is they count the number of jobs that they project to create, and they actually go into their contracts and count how many they have instructed the company to create. They then further use some industry job multiplier numbers to figure out how many additional jobs they expect that to create in other industries. And so we're really not comparing apples to apples in this case, because, like I said, we go 2 years after the fact where the award was made and go into employment data and see how many jobs were actually created and the wages that were paid, whereas they're using projections at the time when the award was made. And so it's a little difficult to compare some of these reports to the practices that we have in Oregon. And that really concludes the main points of our Oregon management response to the Secretary of State's economic development audit. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Questions from the committee?
Yes.
Yes.
So you mentioned the nine projects that fall under your jurisdiction, and four of them were job creation was the goal. So that leaves five others. What kinds of goals do those five have?
Those are traditional co-chairs, members of the committee. Those loans are much more like traditional bank loans, and they are underwritten. And so a company needs to come in and apply for things, and it can be anything from working capital to equipment purchases. And those, the goal there might be job retention instead of job creation, or just keeping a company afloat in bad economic times. And so in terms of the ones that have job creation as a specific goal, it does make up about half of the programs that we're looking at, and most of the incentive programs, but not our traditional underwritten loans or loan guarantee programs.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, additional questions? I did have one. We could spend a lot of time here on the transparency-related issues. Representative Wisden and I and Senator Thatcher, if she was here, spend a lot of time on those issues in terms of we're on the advisory committee for the Oregon Transparency Commission, so they come up. Do you see future improvements in those areas? You've highlighted some of the problems and in terms of data, but do you see improvements possible in those areas?
Co-Chair Devlin, members of the committee, absolutely. We are committed to, like I said, continuous improvement, and I think that our strategic planning process is going to lead specifically to us having program-specific outcomes identified for our programs, and we'll be able to measure and report on those. That is, at this point, probably a few months out. We also do create and track various measures, and that's why it was important to us to work with the DAS Office of Transparency, so that instead of just relying on the information that we're requested to provide in reports, which we have always provided, that we can also begin to upload and put data about our program outcomes on our website and have people go directly to that and then ask us questions if they need any additional information.
Another portion of the actual audit found something that was not unexpected, but that the cost per job created in rural communities is quite high. In fact, it looked like it was about 12 times as high as it is in non-rural communities. In fact, at a level where you could almost say you could go out and hire someone for the cost of the incentive. Yeah. And I noticed at the beginning of your presentation, not you, but the other gentleman stated about the in the development of the strategic plan, part of the goals was to focus on the needs of rural communities, or words to that effect. But people talk about this. I've been in the legislature 21 years. They've talked about this since I came here. I don't think anybody's really figured it out. We have enterprise zones. Those are underutilized, and when we do get them utilized, the cost per job is considerably high. People fault the land use process, but I can tell you that there are areas where you could go out and add 50 acres to a community and you still wouldn't get any buyers for that land, just simply because of other factors. What are other states doing? Because other states are facing similar, and do they have the same kind of outcomes we've had?
Co-Chair Devlin, committee members, that's a fantastic question, and in many cases at the core of what we're doing from a strategic planning perspective. I don't think the rural-urban divide or lack of prosperity in rural areas of our state are unique to Oregon. I think there's a lot of communities and a lot of states struggling with this issue. So it's certainly a focus of ours. Some specifics, yeah, I think often what gets brought to attention related to some of the high cost per job numbers is some of the work we've done to attract and retain data centers. Those have primarily taken advantage of our Enterprise Zone program, which is an abatement for the new investment. So it's not affecting the current tax base. This is the new investment. And certainly, given the size of the investment and the amount of technology going in relative to the number of jobs, that's why you see some of those figures. I do believe when you go out to those communities, and I know Governor Brown was just in Eastern Oregon visiting with some of them, I think many of those communities would say the impacts there have still been influential. Whether it solves rural-urban divide issues, whether it's certainly not the only answer to rural prosperity. Other states, including Oregon, look at that's why we're currently prioritizing small business and entrepreneurship in rural communities. Business Oregon, if you look at it, the entirety of our budget invests a considerable amount in rural infrastructure, everything from industrial lands to brownfields to water, wastewater. We manage the school seismic program, so we play a very foundational and health and safety role in making sure communities are ready to attract business. So I think the answers to that are varied, and I can say with confidence that it's a priority of what we're doing in our strategic planning process right now to find meaningful ways to create jobs, to create prosperity in rural Oregon.
This isn't a statement in any sense negative towards data centers, but, I mean, they're locating there for two reasons. One, the enterprise zone, and probably two, low, because the providers of energy in that area have priority with BPA for hydropower, low-cost hydropower. So, okay. Anything additional?
I have one. One of the things that you just mentioned that was interesting to me, because my understanding of performance measures, kind of an audit, is that you have a criteria of trying to match and see if the program is achieving the goals that they have. Mm-hmm. And you just talked about programs that were to create jobs and programs that were to maintain jobs or have retention of jobs. You talked about, you know, worlds from schools to wastewater. And so each one of those different programs, you know, have a different set of goals of success and a specific goal on what that business or that part of the community is trying to create as better services or to fill a gap or some kind of a transportation or wastewater or whatever infrastructure problem in their community or a lack of something in their community. So I wondered, as you went through the audit, because when I try to go through audits, I try to see if there's anything there that gives me a goal of what was the yardstick,
mm-hmm.
you know, and what would you say was the yardstick that was being used? I mean, I heard your comments just now.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, you know, it says to improve evaluation of business incentives. Well, I'm not sure that I understand what it means to improve evaluations of business incentives in such a diverse landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you have some clues in your world? What were those?
Co-Chair McLean, committee members, the answer to that may be best directed by to the Secretary of State's Audit Division. I think they focus quite a bit on the role of business incentives and the impact that they've had or can have on job creation, and I think we would agree that that's an important metric. I don't think it's the only metric we look at, and I think their focus was specific to some of those business incentives. I mentioned a lot of other programs that were outside of this that we administer related to infrastructure. So each program has, you know, we have goals and objectives, and where we don't have as clear ones, that's why we've launched proactively strategic planning in the fall to make sure we're really honed in on those investments. I do know some of the related to the audit, we are working actively right now on how we, as Ms. Rademacher has mentioned, how we share that better via our website and whatnot, both what the goals and objectives and targets are, and then how we're meeting those.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I realized that they were the person that held the key to that. But what I was trying to do was from someone receiving that input, you know, what they were saying. If I had to ask what, you know, myself after reading it, it would be improving evaluation of incentives and job creation. I mean, those two look to be the metrics to me. But I appreciate your comment. That helped.
Thank you. Mr. Kocher?
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Kocher. My question is to co-chairs. All the publicity this has had and everything, I'm not sure I feel comfortable that we've done everything we can at this point. Do we need to have Secretary of State come back in and talk to them? I want this to succeed. I'm not, I was on higher education and then innovation and all that for the last committee, and we, you know, this is a program I think we need, but the press that it's had, the audit report, I'm concerned that the presentation didn't, the business Oregon is not saying that they have the capability to really analyze the, didn't analyze the people applying for the loans and everything up front. Do you think that this committee has any way to go back and?
I think we should give them a chance to respond, but I think they were saying that they don't analyze, they don't follow them in terms of job creation. I think you probably meet whatever requirements you need to meet in terms of credit worthiness.
Co-chairs Devlin, McLean, members of the committee, we really have two distinct types of programs that are being discussed here. Our business incentives are primarily job creation programs. They are in this report kind of lumped together with what are traditional underwritten bank loan type programs, where the goals of those programs are to make the loan and have the person repay it. And they have the same kind of requirements that you would have in terms of creditworthiness, like you said, to ensure that repayment is going to be possible. And the reason that's important for those business finance programs is that they are self-funded programs, that the money, the fees, and the repayments come back and fund the future loans. And so that those are other fund programs where we're making a variety of different types of loans to businesses as a tool. The incentive programs are primarily jobs programs. You know, as are the enterprise zones. We just don't control the management or the reporting for the enterprise zones. And at this point, not that we wouldn't contribute to evaluating those, we absolutely would and have. We have a long history of working with the Department of Revenue and the Legislative Revenue Office to do that. It's just we can't direct that. That lies somewhere else. And so, you know, we have no objection whatsoever to having program-specific outcomes, but they have to be ones that fit the programs that we're talking about. And that's really the only thing that we're saying is that there were some generalities that came out in the press in terms of the outcome of this audit, and they don't apply to all of the programs that were listed here or that are in Business Oregon.
Representative Wisnant, I do think, though, that, I mean, this is an area where if the committee is expressing additional interest, it's the whole idea behind the committee and fundamentally, that if they're expressing an interest, remember, I mean, sometimes we see the actual audit months before we hear someone in a response. We may have more questions or want to look into it more deeply or bring people back or or not really get a debate between the Audits Division and Business Oregon. But I do think if people on the committee were interested, it would be a worthwhile thing to bring groups back here and to go a little bit deeper into some of these subjects than we can this afternoon. In fact, perhaps devote an entire meeting or more to that. I think that's clearly possible. I mean, if this is an area where people have an interest.
I thank the chair for his comments, and
yeah.
I would recommend that we look at the reports again and everything and discuss it and ask them. Would not ask it today. Maybe that's a suggestion. I think is. I appreciate.
I think there are a lot of questions out there, and probably would be beneficial for people to get a little bit more comfortable.
Thank you for this
with some of the issues. We obviously, if we were in a different environment, we have budget related questions too, but that might not be the most appropriate venue for them. Something to do with where cell phones belong. With that, anything additional? Seeing nothing, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee, I'm going to turn it over to Teresa, Ms. McHugh. She's going to talk briefly. We received a letter from the Secretary of State asking for our input into he didn't put a number on it. Suggestions for audits. And what we thought is we'd use this kind of as an introductory at this meeting, give some people some time. Realistically, I don't think we should make more than two or three audit recommendations, knowing what the limits are for these would be basically performance audits to the Secretary of State. But just starting that discussion here, and Ms. McHugh, do you want to give a little bit of background beyond?
Sure. So you did receive a letter from the Secretary of State. Basically, they're in their planning process right now. And I should mention they didn't leave. Some of them didn't leave because they lost interest. They actually have their budget hearing up this afternoon. So, they're in that process. So the Secretary of State is, as he offered at the last meeting, is wanting to work cooperatively with this committee about any performance audits that you believe would be important for them to do at this time. So to that end, we had this agenda item to talk a little about any that have been raised. A couple have been sent into the committee in general. One was very broad about contracting, which would obviously need to have a discussion about. As we just had a discussion, that can be, if we said do a performance audit on state contracting, we could use the entire team there, probably for several biennia. So you need to hone that in. Another one came in regarding pay equity discussion. So we've had a couple that people have raised with the committee. Obviously, we haven't had
both of those would actually require considerable definition of what.
Absolutely, absolutely. But wanted to talk to the committee about anything that's been on your agenda, something that you think should be dealt with. And along with that, if you saw on the agenda, we talked about not just the audit needs, but criteria that could be used. The Secretary of State does in their administrative rules have a listing of how they kind of look at what items come up for performance audits, and so their criteria for themselves as they look at that. We've started investigating what other states do in terms of criteria, so I think we can provide you more of that in the future, but this conversation could be about creating more of a set of items that you'd have interest in, and then we could come back and hone in on what that means and which ones are the highest priority and which ones are, as we've had a conversation, or I've at least had been able to have a conversation with the Secretary of State, which ones are the type of work that's that makes sense for the Secretary of State Audits Division to do versus items that perhaps you would want Legislative Fiscal to look at or the Legislative Research Office. There's some things that are more of a research kind of a function or that makes sense for different bodies. So with that, this was just to be a general discussion of things that you
and
see.
And we could also have a more prepared discussion on criteria, too.
Correct.
Yeah, what common criteria are used. Representative McLean.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about, was the fact that when you start talking about how limited our resources are for any audits, and how very, you know, small part of the world we're really going to get to review, it seems so important, whether it be the Secretary of State's office or it's our LFO who are busy and important doing other things, or if it's a research, you know, factor or whatever, that we need to have some kind of foundation to make those, any of those decisions or suggestions on. And the three that I want to just to put out there for right now that I've said a couple of times, but is that if we're looking at performance audits, the criteria at least has to look at risk factor. And the risk factor is basically, if we don't audit it, what are the risks, and what kind of risks do we have in that area that causes us to think that this is a high priority audit? And to go along with why does this get prioritized over 10 or 15 other items that are out there is also how discreet and the cost and what we get for that audit or from that audit, not knowing what the results will bring. And then finally, just the idea that it has to be timely. There's some audits that are done, and they're done either too early, and the information has to be refreshed before it can even be utilized, or it's too late, and there have been decisions that have been made that have to be undone because we just didn't look at the timeliness of the audit. So I'm hoping that criteria element is really going to inform what we would suggest to the Secretary of State and what we would suggest for audits that we may want to try and handle with limited funds with different sources. But anyway, I don't know. It just was a passion to me to try to say that today in a way that it would intrigue you guys to want to work on it, because I just don't understand what that criteria is. I haven't found it. I don't understand what I think it is other than just what are good audit criteria. Good audit criteria is something different. That's when you've already decided on what you want to audit. And this is criteria on trying to figure out what is the list that we're going to suggest to the Secretary of State and what is the list that we want to work on in this committee.
I think those are good points.
So we asked also, I think you were asking, we said to send the thing to the Secretary of State, an email or letter. He had asked by March 31st. We said give us till April 10th because we're trying to plan this around the few committee meetings we have every 2 weeks. So we probably need to get, if people have ideas, within probably the next week. And and I know that Representative McLean was, I don't know if you want to comment on that at all. You had one in particular that you...
I had one, but I still don't think I've got it distinct enough, but it was really looking on services of the Department of Education and just really trying to figure out a discrete piece of that. One example that I brought up was grant administration. And also, there's a lot of different elements.
You've been attending the subcommittees on that.
Well, grants
are big.
They are, and it seems to me like, you know, if we could have a distinct element. I tried to find out how long it's been since there's been an audit in that area. But I felt like for efficiency, effectiveness, and use of dollars and or goals of programs.
I didn't realize that this past week, of all my following the school-state formula, that a lot of the grants come out of the education, the K-12 budget, before it's distributed to the school. Was it $300 or $400 million?
That's our issue.
Comes out before it goes to the schools.
A little bit. In terms of the carve-outs, they're smaller.
The carve-outs are smaller than that,
but there are things.
But it was general fund, too. It wasn't just federal funds.
Yeah.
I would think two members of this committee might have some really interesting audits that could help. That was like in the budget process, some questions you're trying to decide or debate.
Helps
you in the future, and then not going to help you this time, probably. But.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested in procurements, but I think that one of the things that we might want to consider when we're trying to whittle down and see where we want is to actually have a conversation with the audits division. To see, you know, how they feel, or, you know, maybe a lot of times, you know, negotiation is a good way to narrow things down and figure out what can be done and, you know, where we want to start.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can think of one that's premature, but there are a lot of questions in the background about the settlement with Oracle and the proceeds from that settlement in terms of services and how that's playing out within agencies. Now, it's probably a little premature to do that now, but a year from now, it might be very appropriate to see how that's playing out.
Yeah, and mine in particular is looking at the exemptions from using the DAS procurements contract writers for procurements and where they allow other agencies to do their own and how that's working out.
Yes.
I've discussed that in the past. I think there's too many people, as I explained about LC, having contract authority. I'd rather see mm-hmm. specialists and better professionals within DAS do more contracting. Some of the agencies.
So we will probably schedule a whole meeting just for these purposes. And one of our next meetings, 2 weeks, what would that
April
be?
April 4th.
I think this is significant, don't you? We talked about this as we reactivated this committee.
Yeah.
That we're getting, Secretary of State's asking us for more input. And I think that's a key thing, the relationship between the two offices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything additional for the good of the order? Mm-hmm. Hearing none, we are adjourned.
So are you okay with the business argument?
Yeah.
The business argument?
Yeah.
So are you okay with...